How to relate to a spiritual mentor, right? Okay? So before we talk about how to relate to a spiritual mentor, let's talk about why have a spiritual mentor. Why do we need one? We live in a society where people are very disillusioned with authority. And we have quite a strange relationship with authority. We idolize them, we give our power over to them, and then we resent them. Yeah? Yeah. I mean, heroes, whatever it is. We idolize a sports hero, we buy all their stuff, and then we put them off their pedestal and put them in the gutter. You know, with movie stars, politicians, whatever. We've also been very disillusioned with a history in Western culture of people fighting wars in the name of God for many centuries, and it's developed a certain kind of suspicion within us, or within some people anyway, about religious people or religious institutions or religious teachers. I studied history in college, and I can't remember any of the facts. Anyway, they aren't facts, they're basically gossip. You know what history is? It's gossip from a man's viewpoint. This is what it is. So-and-so did this, so-and-so did that. Whatever they choose to tell you about, it's what the guys are interested in. Mm-hmm. It's about power, it's about wars, it's about military equipment, isn't it? You know, that's considered history. And it's all gossip, we don't really know what happened. The one thing I got out of it was, I can't remember all the facts now. But what I remember is that European history is just littered with the lives of people who fought in wars in the name of God. Every generation, just about, there was a war in the name of God. Okay, so I'm a perfect example of somebody who's very disillusioned with religious institutions and religious figures, after I studied history. Fortunately, a religion and the institutions are two different things. And I think this is very, very important for people to understand. Okay? Religious teachings can be completely pure and wonderful and really show you the path to becoming a better person. And the people who run the religious institutions cannot follow them. Okay? The teachings themselves were given by, very deeply spiritual, beings. The institutions are created by ordinary living beings. So we have to be very clear about this, okay? Because religious institutions and specific individuals are going to mess up. But that doesn't mean that the belief system or the path propounded by a particular religion is bad. Okay? Don't equate the two. In other words, put it in a Buddhist way, not all Buddhists are Buddhists. You can be a Buddhist without being a Buddha, And many people are Christians without being Christ, and so on and so on. Okay? So, anyway, we come from a society where we have a lot of suspicion about religious leaders and religious institutions. And then we come into Buddhism, where the importance of a spiritual mentor is really emphasized. And not just in the Tibetan tradition, but in all the traditions. It's maybe emphasized more in the Tibetan tradition, but in all the Buddhist traditions, having a spiritual mentor is important. Now, why? Okay, why? Well, to learn any common skill, okay, to learn how to type, you need a typing teacher, don't you? Yeah. To learn how to drive, we needed a driving teacher. To learn math, we needed a math teacher. And to learn English, we had an English teacher. Okay? Anything we know came due to the kindness of other people who taught us. We weren't born with all these skills and knowledge in our own mind. Okay. We've needed teachers for everything. So if we need teachers for common things like typing and driving a car, yeah, and learning how to cook, then definitely we need a teacher for things that are much more difficult, much more intricate, much more perilous if you go astray, such as a spiritual path. Okay. So it's really important to have a teacher. Now, that doesn't mean any old teacher. Yeah. As in any kind of thing where there's teachers, there's some teachers that are qualified and some teachers that aren't. Yeah. Yeah. You can have an unqualified typing teacher. Yes, you know. Like us. So, you know, we need a qualified teacher. And we need a teacher with whom we can have a good relationship, a teacher that we trust. So what are qualities that we look for in a teacher? Okay. In the Mahayana tradition, in one of Maitreya's texts, he talked about this, the qualities to look for in a Mahayana teacher. So one is that this person has good ethical conduct. In other words, whatever level of precepts they have, they keep their precepts well. And that they are an ethical, good human being. Because that's kind of the bottom line, isn't it? Before you can gain any kind of higher realizations, we need to get our life put together, and it's ethical conduct that puts our life together in a reasonable way. Americans have a little bit of confusion about ethical conduct. Yeah, we renegotiate it quite a lot based on what our self-centered thought wants. But if you think about it, ethical conduct is really the basis of having a good life now, as well as the basis of developing all further good qualities. So it's something that's really important. So, you know, bottom line is we need a teacher who has good ethical conduct. Because especially, we're going to model our behavior on our teacher's behavior to a great extent. Now, it doesn't mean we need to like the same things that our teachers like, but we learn through their example. And if our teacher is not acting in an ethical way, then we're going to use that as a rationale to let our own afflicted mind run the show and go here and there and the other place. Okay, so we need a teacher who's going to be a very good example for us in terms of their ethical conduct. Okay, then we need a teacher who has some meditative experience. Because if this person's teaching us how to meditate, how to concentrate our mind, they need to have some experience on how to do that themselves. We want a teacher who has some wisdom, who has some understanding about the ultimate nature of reality and how the ultimate mode of existence and the conventional mode of existence are harmonious and non-contradictory, because that's the thing we really need to realize in order to get out of cyclic existence ourselves. And if our teacher doesn't understand that, they're going to have a hard time leading us. We want a teacher who's operating from a really kind motivation. Yeah, not one who's trying to gather a bunch of disciples around them so that they can have a lot of offerings, or one who wants to take a whole train of groupies, you know, a whole bunch of disciples with them following around so that they receive a lot of praise or put on a good image. We want a teacher who's really genuinely concerned with our own spirit, with our spiritual welfare, and has the capability to lead us on the path. We also want a teacher who's extremely patient. Why? Because sometimes we are not the nicest disciples. Yeah, true or not true? Yeah. We blame our teachers for our problems. We, you know, they ask us for help and we are too busy. We do all sorts of things. We make promises to them and then we break the promises. Our behavior is not always so wonderful. So we want a teacher who's going to be able to hang in there with us and not, you know, just say, oh, this disciple is too much. Yeah. And push us away. Okay? Because the path to enlightenment is going to take a while, and we're probably going to make some mistakes on the way. Yeah? So somebody with, you know, good motivation, somebody who has an incredible amount of patience, somebody who knows how to teach different aspects of the path, who doesn't just know one meditation, yeah, but knows many kinds of meditation so that they can describe to us what we need to do at a particular time. We want a teacher who has a good relationship with their own teacher. Yeah, that's an important thing. Yeah, not somebody who's received kindness from the teacher and then turns around and swears at that teacher. Yeah. Okay. So we want somebody who really has a very deep understanding of the Dharma that comes through study and through practice. Yeah. So we want to look for people who have these kinds of qualities. Yeah. Now, it happens, you know, when we're getting into the Dharma, you know, if you're anything like me, I heard about the Dharma because I saw a flyer in a bookstore and I went. I had no idea who the teachers were. Yeah, I happen to be extraordinarily, amazingly lucky. Yeah, I met some really wonderful teachers who are still my teachers. But so many of us, you know, and especially now, when there's, you know, kind of teachers galore and everybody can declare themselves as a spiritual teacher. When we go in, we should go in and, you know, listen to the teachings. Check up somebody's qualities. We don't have to consider that person our teacher right away. But instead, we listen to their teachings. We observe how they live their life. We watch things. Yeah. We learn from them. We listen to the teachings. We see, is what they're teaching in harmony with the general Buddhist mode of belief and the general Buddhist practice? Or is this person teaching something that they made up? Huh? Because, you know, as Americans, look at the Christian tradition here, what happened. Yeah? We have so many gazillion splinter groups, don't we? In Europe, there aren't so many religions. But we're a country founded on people who split off from their religion in Europe, came over here, established churches of various kinds. Those churches split off. And then you have the fragment of this who split off from the one of that who split off from this and this, don't we? Yeah? I mean, we just have split off religions all the way back. And so you don't know. Anybody could just kind of declare themselves as a spiritual leader, couldn't they? And if you don't know the basic beliefs of that spiritual tradition, then you have no way of knowing, are you getting the actual teachings or are you getting this person's personal opinion? Okay. So it's really important, this with Buddhist teachings, that you really see, is this person teaching according to, you know, the general Buddhist procedure and mode of thinking and mode of acting. Yeah. And especially in the Tibetan tradition, you know, we're kind of special in the Tibetan tradition. Because we have incarnate teachers, yeah, and we have high thrones and brocade and hats. And we have titles, you know. Yeah, there's Geshe and Rinpoche and, you know, Geshe and Rinpoche. But, you know, we have all these external things in Tibetan Buddhism. And actually the other forms of Buddhism do too, but we're kind of more extravagant than all the others. But it's so easy to come in and there's somebody on a high throne with a big hat, with, you know, tons of brocade around and this and that, and we go, you know, and that person has gazillions of titles and we think they must be really important. Okay? His Holiness constantly tells people, don't go by the external appearances. Don't go by somebody's titles. You know, look at somebody's qualities. Look at somebody's qualities. Don't get enamored with the glitter. Yeah, and the height of the throne and the size of the hat and the number of the titles. You know, we have to really look for people who are qualified teachers, okay? Now, at the same time that we're looking for qualified teachers, we have to try and make ourselves into a qualified disciple. Okay, this is something that we don't like to hear about so much. You know, we like to think about how we can, you know, judge the teachers and evaluate them. Who gets the privilege of being my teacher? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, it's the wrong kind of attitude. Yeah, wrong kind of attitude. And so we have to really think about how can I make myself into a proper spiritual vessel so that I can even benefit when I form relationships with different people as my spiritual mentor. Because if I'm all blocked up, I could be sitting in front of the Buddha himself and nothing goes in. Yeah? You know, when you read the scriptures, you know, that talk about the Buddha's life, there were people who, you know, they had, can you imagine meeting the Buddha himself, sitting in the presence of Shakyamuni Buddha, and you come away saying, well, kind of a nice guy. Yeah? So, you know, when our mind is fogged up, you know, even the Buddhas are all around us, we can't benefit. So we have to purify our mind and make ourselves into good disciples. Okay? So how do we do that? One way, I think, is we develop a good motivation and we try and be really sincere about our spiritual practice. This is not so easy. Okay? We are sincere about our spiritual practice when we're lonely and when we're miserable. But when times are good, our spiritual practice is out the door. Isn't it? You know? Your relationship broke up, you're feeling uncertain and insecure, you go, the Dharma makes sense to you, it helps you. Okay? Then you meet somebody else, you go, this person definitely is going to make me everlastingly happy. You know, forget Dharma class. Okay? So we have to really make us try and have a very sincere intention for our spiritual practice. Okay? And this sincere intention takes a while to build up. We don't come into Buddhism necessarily with that. Yeah? I mean, I know I myself, I came in, I was curious. I wasn't really looking for anything. I had a good life. I was a teacher, unemployed for the summer, like most teachers are. Had nothing to do. I was enthralled with Asia. I had just come back from Asia, saw a flyer in a bookstore about some Tibetans teaching a course, and thought, okay, I'll go. Yeah? I didn't have any kind of exceptional motivation. I mean, I had had all the, you know, from the time I was a teenager, a lot of questions about what's the meaning of life and what happens after you die and how do you like make your life meaningful. I had those kind of questions. But, you know, at the time when I met the Dharma, just, let's go, you know. Yeah. Well, over time, after I began to hear the teachings, then my motivation began to change. You know? Because when I went in, I didn't even consider the fact that there could have been past and future lives. I've never been raised with a belief in rebirth. Yeah. So I just came in, you know, because I'm kind of hippie, curious person about, yeah, little did I know. But, you know, it was only after I began to hear the teachings and think about them, yeah, that then my whole intention began to change. Yeah. And I began to think, oh, it's not just the happiness of this life. That's important. Because when I went into the Dharma, I thought I was a pretty nice person. Yeah. And I was convinced that all my problems were due to other people. Yeah. And I went into the Dharma, and there are my teachers, and they're talking about the disadvantages of anger. Well, okay, I can see disadvantages of anger. Yeah, people who get angry at me, they really shouldn't do that. Yeah? Anger has many disadvantages. My anger, on the other hand, was justified and righteous and had valid, solid reasons behind it. Okay, that's how I came in to the Dharma. Well, when Rinpoche starts talking more about the disadvantages of anger, slowly, slowly, I began to think about it. And I began to concede, well, maybe I did have a little bit of anger. And maybe it's not the best motivation to have. But I was pretty dense, you know. I didn't really get the disadvantages of my own anger very easily. So then my teacher sent me, you know, after I ordained, he sent me to work in Italy at a Dharma center with these macho Italian monks. I discovered I had some anger. And, you know, but there's no other way for me to learn than for him to put me, you know, to work in this center 24/7 with these macho Italian monks. And then I discovered I had a problem with anger. Yeah. Even though I was convinced it was all their fault. Somehow, after you've heard enough teachings, even though your mind clicks onto the same old thing, if it's their fault, it's their fault, it's their fault, you know, you've heard enough teachings that say, anger's a defilement. Children, anger is an unrealistic, unbeneficial state of mind. Yeah, I know, but it's their fault that I'm angry. Well, you know, after you've heard enough teachings, eventually you have to, you know, now my anger is my responsibility. You have to start working it. Okay. When I first came into the Dharma, I thought attachment was the path to happiness. I didn't see anything wrong with clinging to attachment. I went, you know, I was attached to everything that seemed like. I went into my first Dharma course. Okay. This is 1975. So some of you have the epic, you know. 1975. Yeah. So I had hair down to here. Yeah. Just had my ears pierced. Big earrings. Frizzy hair. Okay. Peasant blouse embroidered. Yeah. Long skirt made out of fabric. So I had just come back from India. Okay. Anklets, the kind of that makes some noise, the Indian anklets. Yeah. So I come into my first Dharma course thinking that's pretty hot stuff. Yeah. And thinking that attachment was really the path to happiness. And it was only after my teachers began to talk about what attachment was and how it operated in our lives and how it operated in our minds that I started to question. And I began to realize, I have a problem here. You know, it's not just a minor problem. This is major duty problem. And so, again, there started to be some transformation. And the intention began to change as I learned more. But when we come in, you know, we don't know anything. Yeah. So our intention has to develop, and it develops over time, okay? And it develops by hearing the teachings and thinking about them. If we don't hear teachings, then there's no way to get the guidance we need. And if we hear the teachings but don't think about them and don't try and put them into practice and meditate on them, then there's no substantial change in our own mind. Okay. So if we just listen to a lot of teachings, it's nice because we have to really think about them and meditate and try and practice in our daily life. Okay? As we do that, then we become better and better qualified spiritual disciples. So this is a process that goes on. It doesn't happen overnight. It's not that you work for a while and after a year you're a qualified spiritual disciple, so then you quit, you know? No, we're always trying to make ourselves more and more qualified spiritual disciples because we know that the amount, the degree to which we can benefit from being with our teacher depends on how open and receptive we are. So we usually put it on our teacher has to be like this and this and this, and if I make progress, it's because of my teacher. But it's also, if I make progress, it's because of me. Yeah, because I put in the time and the energy. Okay. Another thing to do to make ourselves into qualified spiritual disciples is we have, and this is part of having a sincere intention, is we have to have an ability to hang in there. Okay? If we don't have an ability to hang in there, we're not going to make any kind of progress. Okay? And, you know, when we're kids, we hang in there with our education, don't we? And we go all the way through whatever degree of education we have. Why? Because we see the benefits. Money is at the end. Okay? And be able to get a job and make some money. So we're willing to go through hardships of how many years of school? Okay? In order to make money at the end. Right? Yeah? When it comes to Dharma practice, sometimes there are rough goings in our practice. Yeah, our mind flares up and makes some big story. Things don't go the way we want them to. We have physical problems. We have difficulties with somebody in the group. Whatever it is, if we don't have a long-term motivation, all these small kind of things are going to, you know, become big obstacles for us because we don't have the ability to hang in there through difficulties. Okay. And it's really important. It's called keep showing up. Okay. So it seems like we keep showing up at Dharma class, but what we're doing is we keep showing up to ourselves. Okay, we keep showing up for that spiritual part of ourselves that really has a very deep, sincere longing. That part of ourselves that knows down deep there's something more than just what appears on the surface of this life. And we have to keep showing up to that part of ourselves and keep showing up at Dharma class and to be with our teacher in order to make any progress. Yeah. And this all sounds okay when we're sitting and listening to it, but when it comes in our life, it can be really hard to do. Yeah. What I've found is that there can be the slightest little bit of change and automatically people stop. Yeah. They're married and they get separated. They stop Dharma class. They're single and they get married. They stop Dharma class. They're working and lose their job. They stop Dharma class. They're unemployed and get a job. They stop Dharma class. They're sick and they get healthy. They stop Dharma class. They're healthy and they get sick. They stop Dharma class. You know, it's like any kind of change, and then all of a sudden, you know, bye bye. And what that shows is that our motivation at that particular period of time was not a deep motivation. We were motivated in getting some benefit from the Dharma that would help us live our life in a better way right now. And there's nothing wrong with that motivation, you know, to help us with whatever problems we're having in our life. So we come to Dharma and we learn for that reason. We get some benefit. We can live better. okay? But then, that motivation alone is not going to sustain us over a long period of time, because as soon as our initial problem becomes better, then why go? Yeah? So to really go deeply in the Dharma means that we have to actually cultivate an intention for liberation, an intention for enlightenment, okay? Which means we have to look beyond this lifetime. Yeah, because if we really want liberation, we really want enlightenment, we have to have a big picture, really big picture, that has to go beyond little old me in this lifetime. So that big picture takes some time to develop. So for some people, you know, it's their Dharma practice is fits and starts. They do a little bit, then you don't see them for a while. Then they do a little bit more, and you don't see it for another while. Then they do a little bit more, and bye-bye. You know, until, yeah, at least they keep coming back over time, you know. But still, it's fits and starts. And that's because the motivation at that time is not yet deep enough. Yeah. So we have to really continuously cultivate a very deep motivation that's going to give us the ability to go through whatever we encounter in our spiritual practice without giving up, okay, and without giving up on ourselves. So that's really important, and it takes time. It takes time. It doesn't happen at the beginning, okay? But to think about this, because the bigger and more long-term our motivation is, the easier practice becomes. Why? Because we're not hoping for instantaneous, Rawi Kazawi, Wellmo Zemo experiences. Yeah. At the beginning, we all come in, I don't know if you're like me, I'm kind of dilettante, kind of waiting to have some woo experience. Yeah, because that's what I thought spirituality was at that time. You know, you have some woo experience. And then, of course, you can go talk to all your friends about it. Ooh, I think I realized emptiness. Ooh, I was one with everything. You notice that? I was one with everything. Yeah? What kind of experience is that? The I has now become everything. Instead of just being small, I has enlarged to encompass everything. Yeah, I'm one with everything. Huh? Excuse me? We want some kind of woo thing. But, I don't think that real spiritual progress is about wowie-kazowie experiences that we can write up in Time magazine. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's really about steady, stable practice and becoming a better human being. Mm-hmm. One time I was in Hong Kong giving a talk to some children at the international school. A little kid raises his hand. And this was in the age of Uri Geller. Do you remember him? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the guy who could bend spoons. Mm-hmm. So this little boy, can you bend spoons? I think he thought I sat next to God or something, Can you bend spoons? And I said, mm-mm. And anyway, I don't think it's so important. It would probably just upset somebody who that spoon belonged to. Mm-hmm. The ability to bend spoons, how does that help anybody? So what? You can bend spoons at a distance, okay? One little girl asked me if I talked to God. I had to tell her no. Yeah? But really, it seems to me, when I look, and I look at the example of my teachers never, ever talk about having wowie-kazowie spiritual experiences. Yeah. You ever heard His Holiness get up on the stage and say, I saw Chenrezig and I am Chenrezig. Yeah, Dalai Lama do that? No. People are all around going, you're Chenrezig, you're Chenrezig. And His Holiness says, I'm a simple Buddhist monk. That's all. That to me is an indication of somebody who has realizations. Yeah. The people who go around saying, I've realized this, and I've realized that, and I've seen this, and I've seen that. First of all, you know, in Buddhist monasticism, it's against the precepts to talk about whatever you've realized. Yeah. But second of all, why go around telling everybody? What benefit is it? Yeah. But, you know, we're Americans, and we like movie stars, and we like idols. Yeah. And somebody that comes and says, I'm enlightened, and we go, you know, and we follow them. I had a friend in Mexico, PhD in physics, and one Swami, this many years ago, came and told my friend, oh, you're the disciple that I've been looking for. You know, I've been looking for somebody who's going to be my chief disciple, who's so wise, who's so dedicated, who has so much spiritual potential. My friend has eaten this up, you know? So his whole family got involved with the movement of this Swami, following him, until a few years later, my friend realized that the Swami was molesting his teenage daughters. And then he woke up, and he realized that he started following this person simply because that person had flattered him. You know? You're the disciple I've been waiting for. Yeah. We love that kind of talk, don't we? Yeah. We want our spiritual master to come. Oh, you're so good. I mean, I remember being in a retreat in the early years, sitting there, you know, in meditation, thinking, I'm sure my teacher has spiritual powers. You know, clairvoyant powers. And I know he's watching me do this meditation and he's thinking, what a good meditator. Boy, was I off base. You know? Just pure ego on my part. Yeah. Caught my own distractions. I wasn't meditating at that moment. The moment I was fantasizing. Yeah. Okay.